Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, rally in North Carolina to save HBCUs. Hundreds flock to the state capitol to voice concerns over a bill that will drastically cut funding. Now the sponsor says he's upset because people are not giving him credit, and so he's just doing the right thing. I'm going to show y'all his whining in just a moment. Also on the show, punished for honoring your heritage, a high school senior booted from graduation by police escort for wearing a kente cloth with his cap and gown. What the hell is wrong with these school officials? We'll talk about that on the show. Also, celebrating black women, HelloBeautiful.com is ready to introduce you to some amazing black women, the forefront of creating change in the community in their new web feature, Women to Know. Actor, activist, and filmmaker Nate Parker fills me in on the challenges he faced making the independent film Birth of a Nation and why depicting the painful past of our ancestors at the box office is a necessity. Yes, Snoop Dogg, run and tell that. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. Folks, I was in North Carolina on yesterday at a rally led by supporters of HBCUs dealing with Senate Bill 873. We've been covering this story since that bill was introduced that would slash tuition at five state schools to $1,000 a year, $500 a semester. But that, of course, would cause those schools to lose tons of funding. Legislature says, well, we'll go ahead and put that money back into the schools. But that means they would have to ask for the money every single year. Opponents of the bill made sure all voices were heard.
Whether you know it or not, our future in education is in jeopardy. The historical black colleges and universities of North Carolina are at risk of becoming extinct. We are in jeopardy. Senate Bill 873 proves this. A direct attack on our education, culture, and future.
This is what alumni and students coming together looks like. This is what student power looks like. We are advocates for student power, and we encourage everyone to reach out to Black universities so that we can start empowering each other and have HBCU solidarity across the state.
The key to opportunity in this country is education. And without question, there is no doubt about the impact that historically black colleges and universities have had on this nation and on our state. We are fortunate in North Carolina to have 10 HBCUs, 5 public and 5 private. And those 10 institutions have an impact of upwards of $2 billion annually on our state's economy.
We all agree we have to preserve HBCUs, both public and private. Going forward, we need to bring the best minds and the best experience to ensure we do that. Anything less casts a shadow and a question on what the legitimate purpose is and what will be the outcome. How do we sustain whatever plan we have? How do we sacrifice and recognize the benefit of having that plan? If we do not do that, we will not have all the stakeholders at the table. We will not have all the stakeholders faithfully participating, and the plan will not succeed.
When I see young men come and young women come to our institution every year with the commitment to learn and the willingness to contribute to society, we cannot afford to close not one door at a historically black college. What we should be talking about is how can we increase the number of students who are attending historically black colleges. That's the discussion that needs to be held in the state of North Carolina. The words of Angela Davis. If they come for you tonight, they will come for us tomorrow.
What we have seen across this country has been a consistent effort to undermine historically black colleges and universities from the moment they started. So I asked someone the question, and I assumed the answer. I wanted to be sure. I asked the question, when was the article passed that they are basing this on? That is Article 9 in your state constitution. What they are doing is they are literally using a law that was driven through the process by freed slaves to now hurt the ancestors of those freed slaves in 2016.
As a recipient, beneficiary, and product of an HBCU, I am proud that we put out the best and we put out the brightest. We have corporations from all over America who come and draw from our wealth and our human capital. It is time that we stand up and demand that this legislature, instead of just taking of our fruit, you better feed the root. And when you're feeding the root, make sure you put the appropriations in place that we all can survive and thrive.
All right, folks, on the panel to talk about this particular effort, we have Dr. Greg Carr, Afro-American Department Chair at Howard University, Shermichael Singleton, a Republican political strategist, Lauren Victoria Burke, Managing Editor for Politic365.com, Will Jawando, a former White House official with President Barack Obama. Folks, here's what's finding me interesting. First of all, guys, do we have the video of the sponsor? He gave an interview with a local reporter saying that that he may very well pull the HBCUs out of this bill because he's hurt.
Right.
He's hurt that he is being attacked, and that he saw this as a very good thing. It was that he sounded like Donald Trump at his vets rally saying, you know, why aren't y'all giving me credit for doing this when the fact of the matter is, they've cut $1 billion for higher education. Second of all, the bill initially was to study changing the names of the schools. Then the fundamental problem with this particular bill is that the General Assembly cannot tell future General Assemblies how to fund the schools. So when they say we'll give the $70 million back, there's no guarantee those schools will get that money every year.
Yeah, every state legislature plays this game with HBCUs, particularly if there's a Republican governor, which there is in North Carolina. And HBCU funding, I think HBCUs, quite frankly, over the last 8 years have had the hardest time they've been having in about three decades on the federal level and on the state level. Obviously, on the federal level, they have Parent Plus and some other policy decisions by the Obama administration, namely 2 years free community college, et cetera, which would have hurt HBCUs. And on the state level, it's always been a struggle. So the last thing we need to hear is another attempt to, and I love how it's veiled. It's got something, the bill's got some name like, you know, the Funding of Colleges Act or something like that. And obviously the intent is to defund HBCUs.
Right, well, it's so interesting, Roland, because, you know, as a Republican, and Lauren, you and I talk about this often, mm-hmm. we talk about crime rates and how we want to lower crime rates in these inner cities, and we want to give opportunities to these struggling kids from single-parent households,
right.
Yet we have an opportunity to potentially do that by giving access to a quality education, and what we're essentially saying is, no, we're going to take the money away. That, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
They put two things in conflict, right? Affordability. We've heard mm-hmm. the Obama administration talk about that. They say, well, we want to make it affordable, and in the bill, when you look at the language of the bill, they talk about graduation rates, they talk about improving that, they talk about, you know, the fact that people come out in debt, $23,000 average in debt. But what you see is the name change thing is very important in this. Public legislation that follows in the suit of stuff like the Louisiana the Louisiana court decisions, the Mississippi stuff, Ayers versus Fordyce, the Geyer decision in Tennessee. The first thing you want to do is change the name. Why? We're trying to change the complexion of these institutions.
Right. Right.
But when you push it as affordability, my friend at Winston-Salem State, the dean, Corey Walker, has said there are many moving parts, but there's one objective, which is why I thought it was very interesting and very encouraging to see all those black colleges standing in solidarity.
Let's back up 1 second. Affordability, if the issue is affordability, which is an issue in higher education across the country, right?
Exactly.
Obviously. And, you know, black institutions, you know, when the general public has a cold, you know, we have the flu, right? And so HBCUs have fallen into that category. If you're the state senate in North Carolina, which we need to be leery of anyway with the stuff that they've been passing around transgender and voting rights, but if you're the Republican majority there, why not raise funding for higher education down 20% since 2008?
Right.
And so the idea that you're going to take something good and make it look like you're increasing funding across the board, but you're not.
Conquer, right? Because they said they're going to subsidize scholarships for A&T in North Carolina Central, which is why it's very encouraging to see A&T and Central students out there.
Up.
Yes, and the president is saying,
if it was an affordability issue, you would do it through Pell or you would do it through some direct help to the students.
Raise funding.
It's clear. I mean, it's the same old game of, you know, trying to hurt HBCUs, but of course never declaring it. So from a PR standpoint, as usual, the North Carolina GOP has their PR game down. Of course they're not going to come out and say, okay, we'll cut HBCUs.
Here's what's interesting. So Tom Apodaca, who was a state legislator, the Republican, who pushed this effort, this is what he said. I've also been disappointed in being called a racist and a bigot. And he said, talked about how he was trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
And then he literally gave an interview where he said, you know, well, fine, you know, we'll figure out some other ways how to do good with this money. I mean, it was very paternalistic, very arrogant.
With what money?
It was interesting, though, because first of all, because of the pressure, he has now said the three HBCUs are going to be removed from the bill.
Right.
Now, first of all, I want to actually see it happen before I take his word.
Right.
So the pressure that's been on his behind, Sharmichael, is causing him to respond. But my problem is this here. As opposed to you saying, well, I want to slash these five schools, and one of them is his alma mater, Western Carolina.
Which they added at the end.
Right. But also, the reasoning he gave was to increase enrollment. But Western Carolina is almost at maximum enrollment.
Right.
UNC Pembroke also at maximum enrollment.
So why not?
If that's the motive, how is it the motive when two of the five are at maximum enrollment?
If the motive, again, like you say, Roland, is to increase the amount of students entering into these institutions, why not figure out ways to increase funding so these institutions can build new buildings, hire new professors?
Because that is the motive.
That is logical.
Exactly right. And so, in fact, I told the folks yesterday, because there was a meeting with community leaders and state legislators, I said, y'all should follow the lead of the folks in Maryland and follow what happened in Mississippi.
That's exactly
And in fact, in the meeting, I even called Alvin Chambliss, who was a lawyer, who argued the case in Mississippi that went all the way to the Supreme Court that got them the funding. Yes. I said, y'all should sue the state of North Carolina for not funding these schools from day one.
Because that really is the strategy.
Well, it was interesting.
Alvin Chambliss is a hero, man. He really should be their consultant.
No, seriously. Sitting in the meeting, they said, well, that's one of the things we talked about. I said, no, this ain't talking. I said, the threat of the lawsuit would then force them to step up. And I said, you know what? Again, y'all, I don't sit there and play around with it. I literally said, fine. I literally called Alvin Chambliss in the meeting. And put him on speakerphone and said, y'all need to call him. Because you see the suit right now in Maryland.
Yeah.
The only way you're going to force the hand of these HBCU, of these states, is that they've actually joined together and filed lawsuits against the state to get the money.
Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That's been going on for years. And DOJ needs to step up on stuff like that. They step up on other things, but that has been going on for years in a lot of states, certainly not just North Carolina, but a lot of southern states, they just don't fund them.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We were at a continuing legal education forum at the NAACP convention last summer. And Alvin Chambliss and I both talking about Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Right.
That's what it's for.
Right.
And Chambliss was trying to convince these folks to think about that as a real weapon. Because they were going to close Mississippi Valley. They were going to absolutely downgrade Jackson State. And that war, and I first met Alvin Chambliss as a clerk for the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, because what sent me to law school was the Guyer case in Tennessee. They wanted to change the name of Tennessee State to the University of Tennessee at Nashville. Part of the problem is a lot of these public HBCUs are in state capitals, and they are the public institution in those capitals.
Right.
They want those institutions. So maybe you shut them down and reimagine
them. Right. Hold on. So Apodaca, he talked to a local reporter. I want to play some of that. Y'all go ahead.
We're trying to have them survive. And what really upsets me is my alma mater is in this bill. And I would do nothing to hurt my alma mater. I met my wife there. My two children graduated from there. So I'm extending this across the state geographically. But, you know, I'm to the point now, if perhaps they don't want to be in this bill, I'll be willing to take them out. And we'll just do one campus, because I've never tried to help people in my life and be treated so poorly and be called names that I was called yesterday by Reverend Barber. And I'm hurt. So trying to help people, but they don't want to be helped. I can't do anymore.
So your school is Western Carolina?
Yes, yes. I was on the board of trustees there. My wife and I met there. My two sons graduated from there. And Lord knows I love nothing like Western Carolina University and would never do anything to hurt it. And this was a way to help everybody rise. But if they don't want it, that's fine with me.
So the next question then is, what happens next if you're willing to take them out of the bill? What does that look like?
I guess they can just go their way like they're going now without any additional assistance. We're just trying to help keep our HBCUs. Now, the legacy will always be there. We want the universities to be healthy and to thrive. And they're not right now. Some of them are, most of them aren't, because, you know, kids have decided to go elsewhere. So we're just trying to help with that. But, you know, if they don't want the help, that's fine. We can certainly spend that $70 million somewhere else.
Last question.
Yes, sir.
So what does it look like then if you're going to take them out? Is that just you saying that?
No, I'm thinking about it now. After the responses I've had the last 24 hours, I'm going to probably file an amendment and just take them out and let them continue.
So what he's saying is, it's fine. Y'all ain't getting more money. As opposed to, sure, Mike, go ahead. Because look on your face, above your fellow Republican, you look a little astonished. Hold on one second. Go ahead.
I mean, I am, because, again, as I was just whispering to Lauren as we were watching this video, there is a huge opportunity here. And Roland, we talk about this. Republicans are always talking about how we want to outreach to people. We want to grow the tent, reach new communities. We have an opportunity to go into urban centers, give money to these institutions to hire new professors, to build new buildings, to get the resources they need, lowering crime, provide economic opportunity, possible entrepreneurship. I could go down the line. Why wouldn't you want to provide a logical and substantive policy to make that happen?
We're not seeing that.
He seems to think that cutting the tuition would somehow increase the money.
The a lot of students aren't going to these institutions, they're going to other institutions.
The issue is always
they offer scholarships, et cetera.
Let's back up to, we want to help them survive. Let's just that, which is the way he starts the clip. We've been surviving for 500 years, right? You know, and thriving.
Like Kentucky State, yeah, West Virginia State, Bluefield State. In other words, they'll always have a historical mark on the campus. But we want your property.
The paternalism.
And one of the folks yesterday said these campuses have extremely valuable property.
Of course they do. Yeah. And I was recruited. I'm a proud North Carolina Central alum.
Yes, sir.
Went there, played basketball, got recruited by Western Carolina, didn't go, went to North Carolina Central. And the idea that you're going to help us survive. These schools have been thriving, produced so many graduates, if you don't want to accept this deal where we change your name, change your history, change the purpose of your schools, no money for you.
So what's offensive to me is, fine, you don't want it, well, then you figure out what you're going to do. Versus saying, let's come up with another way.
A missed opportunity.
Well, no, that's called showing real motive. That's called real motive. That's why North Carolina, y'all should be filing a class action lawsuit against the state of North Carolina for severely underfunding HBCUs historically. And so what we're going to actually do is, on Monday's show, we'll reach out to Alvin Chambliss and have him on the show so he can explain to y'all what he did in Mississippi and what he's been trying to tell other folks across the country when it comes to suing these states not funding HBCUs. Up next, black woman in Illinois in trouble for firing warning shots. Seriously, y'all, it's an unbelievable story. Firing warning shots at the folks kill her fiance. Oh, wait till we come back. Also, a Black Lives Matter activist in LA found guilty of lynching because of her role in a police clash. Yeah, we'll explain it. 18 after the hour, News 19 TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Folks, a stunning story out of Chicago. A 26-year-old woman facing felony charges for using a gun to fire warning shots into the air. This after witnessing the death of her fiancé over Memorial Day weekend. Ashley Harrison and the father of her two children, Garvin Whitmore, were headed from their suburban home in Aurora to Chicago to pick up Harrison's aunt. When they stopped at a traffic light, an unidentified man with a gun walked up to the car and shot Whitmore in the head. Harrison immediately reached for a handgun and fired warning shots in the air to scare off the assailant. As the gunman fled, Harris held her dying fiancé until help arrived. but it was too late. Whitmore died at the scene. Harrison was held on a $250,000 bond and charged with reckless discharge of a firearm and aggravated unlawful use of a weapon. She is currently on house arrest and will be under 24-hour surveillance. She is expected to return to court tomorrow. What the hell is wrong with the folks in Chicago charging this woman?
Well, we already learned with Marissa Alexander that black women are not really able to defend themselves with firearms. You'll notice the NRA is, of course, silent during this. You know, normally there would be some sort of, wow, you know, she should be able to defend herself, she should be able to use a firearm, etc. When it's George Zimmerman, it's okay. When it's this woman, there's a problem.
The dude walks up, shoots a fiance in the head, but she's sitting in the car.
But you right. see, I mean, you know, you saw all the organizations trying to get out there and get ahead of violence in Chicago. The idea, there were 68 people shot right. over in Memorial Day weekend. I think some of this is political. They're trying to send a message. What they may be trying to do is say, we're not going to have vigilante justice. Of course they can't justify it, but it's the politics. Exactly right. What we don't want you all to do is start shooting each other in self-defense. Right. And you're absolutely right to put a black woman in that position. Right. Now, if that were a white woman,
to put
you,
woman.
She would be a hero.
She'd be a hero. She'd be a folk hero by now.
Exactly. That's the definition. Exactly right. You know, I'm a lawyer of self-preservation and self-defense. your fiance has been shot, you know, God bless his soul and her that situation in front of you, and you're fearful for your life, and you pull out a gun and shoot. I mean, that's just classic. And the fact that they would charge her when you have almost 70 people shot over Memorial Day weekend in Chicago, and that's the focus of your law enforcement to arrest a woman like this?
Isn't it interesting that she shot in the air? She right. feared for her right. life and right. shot in the air. Now, right. why can't law enforcement do
that? Right. Right. Here's the other right. piece. Now, she could have shot at the assailant, no, right. but what happens is, look, understanding you could hit somebody, right. Right. it wasn't your attention, right. but she fires in the air and you arrest her? I mean, here's a woman who goes through a traumatic experience holding her dying fiance. He right. dies in her arms, right. yet she goes to jail.
Right, and I'm assuming mm-hmm. the reason she did that, I mean, imagine if she didn't have the gun, she probably would have been shot as
yeah.
well. So I think it's ridiculous that, you know, in America, you cannot have the right and the ability to defend yourself.
No, but where in the hell, as Lars said, where's the NRA?
It's rolling. Where's
Wayne LaPierre defending this black woman?
I'm not saying that, but
it's just like I asked the question yesterday in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Where were the LGBT activists standing with the folks fighting for the HBCUs?
Well,
when the black folks were sitting there fighting against the transgender bill, mm-hmm. had a brother who said, hey, I'm with an HBCU initiative with HRC. I said, no, the president of HRC, Human Rights Campaign, was down in North Carolina. Just so the same thing, if LGBT folks want black folks on their side, staying with the black folks, fight for HBCUs, NRA should be saying, since they believe in God,
I agree.
And believe in the Second Amendment, they should be saying, we're going to fund her law.
No, this story is unfolding. Watch, if he has presence of mind, how quickly does Donald Trump jump on this and turn it into a conversation about black criminality?
Well, he ain't that smart.
But think about it.
That smart.
Why was she shooting?
You know, I can't remember a time when the NRA has jumped on the side of somebody who's African American in this situation.
Right.
And there's been a few cases like this.
The only time they jumped on the side of somebody black was the brother who sued the city of Chicago against their handgun bill that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the only time.
But when
there's a case right. like then there was some gun folks.
Because Marissa Alexander, that should have been an easy.
Oh, absolutely.
One.
There were some gun folks who were behind a brother who got shot at the Walmart Beaver Creek, Ohio. John Crawford. There was some who stood with him, but did Wayne LaPierre and the national NRA stand up?
Right.
No.
No.
And they didn't.
This is a classic Second Amendment case. I mean, it's self-defense, and she had the permit, and so, this is Second Amendment. It's
all
open.
Right, folks, so we come back 1 second. We're going to talk about this case out of L.A. A Black Lives Matter activist clashed with police last year. She gets charged and convicted of lynching? We'll talk to a BLM leader in California. Also, Nate Parker has his movie coming out, The Birth of a Nation, dealing with Nat Turner. We'll talk to you, show you that. But also, a high school senior wears kente cloth with his cap and gown, escorted out by cops. What is wrong with these folks at these schools? We'll break it all down right here on News 1 Now TV.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now. with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
A former Florida cop is charged for the fatal shooting of church drummer Corey Jones. Newman Raja is charged with manslaughter and attempted murder for the shooting on October 18th. Investigators say Jones was tending to his SUV on the side of the road early in the morning in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, when the plainclothes officer pulled up in an unmarked cargo van. Jones was armed at the time, but had a concealed weapons permit. Raja never identified himself as a police officer, but then shouts for him to put his hands up. Prosecutors say an audio recording and physical evidence show Jones had thrown his weapon and was running away when he was shot. Raja was fired from the force weeks after the shooting. If convicted, he faces up to life in prison. In a statement, Jones' family says they are relieved by the charges. Folks, two Minneapolis police officers will not face civil rights charges in the shooting death of a young black man. Federal authorities made the ruling yesterday in connection to the shooting death of Jamar Clark. The officers involved, who are both white, say they were trying to arrest Clark when they shot him in the head in November. Activists say Clark was handcuffed when he was shot, but federal and state investigators determined that wasn't true. There's now an internal investigation into the department to determine if Clark's civil rights were violated. The Department of Justice is also reviewing how the city responded to protests following Clark's death. There's at least one federal lawsuit filed accusing the officers of using excessive force with protesters on November 18th. A few days later, four men were charged with shooting at least five demonstrators in what prosecutors say was a racially motivated attack. Those cases are still pending. Now, folks, another big story we wanted to talk about comes out of California. The organizer for the Black Lives Matter Pasadena, California chapter is facing prison time after being found guilty for committing crimes during a clash with police last year. The entire incident was caught on video. Take a look.
Okay, she's only 130 pounds. She doesn't weigh that much. Come on, guys.
Officers arrested Jasmine Richards in August, days after she and others were protesting at a park. Yesterday, a jury found her guilty of attempting to unlawfully remove a suspect from police custody during that protest. Oddly enough, the technical term for that charge is lynching. She's the first black person to ever be convicted of lynching in America. Richards will be sentenced next Tuesday. Joining me on FaceTime from L.A. is Patrice Cullors, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Patrice, what do you make of this particular case here? There were other trials that took place where individuals were found not guilty. What was so different about this one?
Well, I want to be clear. Pasadena, California is a suburb inside L.A. County. It is the suburb in which Kendrick McDade was murdered by Pasadena police officers. It was a huge issue here in Los Angeles County, and those police officers have not been held accountable. And so Jasmine was really one of the first people out of Pasadena speaking up and out against the issue of Kendrick. Kendrick was shot in an alleyway. Police officers sat in their car when they shot him. They didn't even get out of the car. And then they ran him over with their car. And so what we're seeing actually is Jasmine Abdullah as a political prisoner.
And so by saying, by calling a political prisoner, first of all, what happened was the moment she was found guilty, they immediately took her away and she'll be sentenced. How many years are we talking about she's facing?
Anywhere from 6 months to 4 years. Obviously, if it's over a year, then it's state prison time.
What's the appeal process? What do you and others plan on doing to help her out of the situation?
We're working with our legal team at this moment to see what are the best options for Jasmine and see what she wants to do. I mean, if folks have ever met her, she is one of our most powerful leaders. She is born and raised in Pasadena. The Pasadena chapter is mostly young black boys, anywhere from 10 to 13 years old. They use that park as their place to organize. And people know Jasmine as the activist, as the organizer inside of Pasadena, and she shows up relentlessly for Black folks.
So do you believe that when you look at this, when you look at the sentence given to the brother in Ferguson, who's serving more time than anybody else, when you look at some of these other cases, do you believe that when you have the likes of Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, Megyn Kelly, and others constantly attacking Black Lives Matter, when you hear police officers talk about Black Lives Matter, Donald Trump, when you hear even the FBI director keep talking about this Ferguson effect, do you believe that Black Lives Matter activists have been so effective that there is a very deliberate attempt by law enforcement to take them down?
Definitely. I mean, this is, if we look back in history, we've seen this happen to organizers, activists, protesters. When we stand up for our rights, Black folks in particular, we're the first ones to be taken down by law enforcement, the first ones to be charged, to have trumped up charges. And so this moment in history, we're seeing a resurgence of a Black liberation movement. And we're also seeing a resurgence of political prisoners. And unfortunately, Jasmine Abdullah is one of those.
All right, Patrice Cullors, we appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Real quick, want to go to our panel here. Folks, this is, again, there's no doubt in my mind, I've been saying this, the effectiveness of Black Lives Matter, various activists across the country, is putting a level of pressure on police they have never felt, and they cannot handle the scrutiny they are now under.
That's true. I mean, you know, think about it. I mean, at the end of the day, what you have is wide latitude. Police powers have wide latitude. This young person intervened. And in intervening, what they're trying to do is send a message. You cannot stop the police. And you're right. They can't really regulate this Black Lives Matter movement. It is decentralized. It is a more sentiment. And as it forms itself, they can't touch any one place or any other place. What happened in Minneapolis is very clear as well. Two inquiries, allowing the police to do what they've done, but what they can't do is stop the pressure that's being mounted in the streets.
Because also what we see, and again, I'm linking several, that we see, you know, they talked about the code of silence with Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. You look at this code of silence that's happening in Baltimore as well, where in the Freddie Gray case. And the bottom line is this here. They are angry at Marilyn Mosby. They are angry at any other DA who chooses to go after them. And there's no doubt in my mind that there's a deliberate attempt by cops across this country to slow down, to not actually get involved in policing streets, because they want to see this happen, because they want to say, we gonna show y'all. Y'all come after us and hold us accountable, then we gonna show y'all who has power.
The common denominator, though, is who the victims are, because if the victims were Hispanic or gay, this wouldn't be happening, right? And we really believe that if this was someone else, if these were not African Americans, that this thing would be okay? Of course it wouldn't be okay. So, yeah, I agree with you that it is the pressure on police and all that, but to me it's about the victims and who gets locked up for these ridiculous
real quick,
charges.
Then, Shermichael, because you had a look on your face, you want to disagree with me, you better tread real carefully. Ask Snoop Dogg. Yeah. Will?
So here's the thing. The Black Lives Matter activists have pulled the curtain back on what has been a history of excessive force. That's why they're pushing for things like changing the use of force standard. Because right now you can get off unless you can prove that the officer did not have fear for their life to
right.
use deadly force, which is a standard that is totally unreasonable, not used anywhere else in the international world.
Right.
Okay. You got folks. The problem is that when these arrests happen, you need the rest of the community to step up and say that this is not justified.
Because sure,
the
exactly.
issues they're That's raising right. are important.
now, you know, Roland, all I have to say, you know, I better be very carefully on this one. All I'm going to say is, look, if police are in the process of arresting someone, I don't think you should interfere. I don't. I think it's too dangerous. That's why we have cell phones. You try to combat this legally, which Black Lives Matter is doing, continue to protest, mm-hmm. etc., bring a lot of attention to these issues. But to get involved
I just think it's foolish.
You don't view the charges as a too much government issue. Yeah. You don't view the charges.
I didn't say that. But what I'm saying is that she should not have gotten involved with the police.
See, if this was happening in China, you wouldn't be saying
that. That's all I'm saying.
If this was another country, you wouldn't be saying
that. That's all I'm saying.
You'd be saying, "Oh my God, China's terrible." But what happens here is like it's magically okay.
No, I didn't say that. I just said that it's dangerous to get involved with.
Well, if that is getting involved, I mean, she wasn't standing in front of a tank in Tiananmen Square. I mean, that is not. She said the girl, whoever she was taking down, doesn't weigh a lot. Be careful. She's not that big.
I didn't see her literally blocking the police car and getting in the way.
You don't think it's dangerous for the police to arrest somebody on Trump's
justified
charge
in light of police violence?
Of course sure, Michael, you can chew on that one in the break. Coming up, a high school senior punished for honoring his heritage wearing a kente cloth graduation, and he gets escorted out by cops. Also, my one-on-one with Nate Parker talking about Nat Turner, Birth of a Nation. We'll chat about Roots series as well. 20 before top of the hour, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
You also recorded. Thank you very much for walking me out of the group for no reason. Appreciate it, guys. Have a nice day.
That video was taken by Nyree Holmes, a high school senior who police escorted out of his graduation ceremony for wearing kente cloth. The 18-year-old at Cosmonis Oaks High School in Elk Grove, California, chose to sport a traditional African kente cloth stole with his cap and gown at the graduation, which is seen at numerous graduations across the country. After walking across the stage to get his diploma, the merit scholar was escorted out of the building by cops for what school officials say was a violation of the graduation dress code and refusal to adhere to several requests to remove the kente cloth. The Elk Grove United School District released this statement. The district's approved graduation uniform is a cap and gown. Students may wear stoles, cords, or medals that have been earned and awarded to students at prior ceremonies. Unfortunately, prior to the COHS graduation ceremony, school officials were not given the opportunity to discuss with the family the student's desire to wear the cloth.
But he couldn't wear
the cloth. Okay. So you mean tell me you called the cops?
Right.
That's the problem.
To say, we got to escort you out. Right. Not
from your graduation.
Not if you're the principal or somebody, you admonish him on the stage, or you say, now look, you know you weren't supposed to do this here.
That's right.
But a warning, whatever. But you call the cops.
Well, and that's the problem. I mean, you know, the kente cloth, as you said, it's ubiquitous, particularly in college graduations. Everybody has them. K-12 is different. Speech, you know, that it's regulated differently. I looked at the high school handbook for Cosumnes Oaks, and they talk about the fact that you can wear your honors cords. Now, the question is, did anybody else have anything on that they shouldn't have? And you're right. They're within their rights to regulate. But when you put the police on it, now you've turned it into something very different.
These people have too much time on their hands. Yeah, I mean, it is like the second, even if it was a violation, you gonna stop the whole graduation and call the cops over?
Literally, well, walks across the stage, the cops are waiting for him.
Who cares?
At the stairs, and you lead him out.
It's another lawsuit.
Yeah, and
because they put him out and let him come back in.
I think I don't know any student who wouldn't have listened to an administrator who said, "Look, just take it off." They said, "Okay, fine. It's graduation.
No, but
take it off."
Now you raise another issue, though, Sir Michael. He should not have had to take it off. The man is Ghanaian. Even if he wasn't, this is everywhere now.
Oh yeah, but
Hold up. You don't run over that. Ain't no speed bump. He's what?
He's Ghanaian.
He's Ghanaian. And he said, this Ghanaian connects cloth me to my cloth. And you know what? And I tell you, I wear a full robe with West African cloth. I don't even wear kente. Why? Kente is royal cloth. It's become a commercial thing. Right. That boy is Ghanaian. And that was woven kente. You can see it on the picture right there. He should not have to explain that.
So you tell me if a Jewish student had a yarmulke?
Come on. Well, no. I read the handbook. They allow for Muslim headdress. They allow for religious headdress.
Religious.
This is a gray area.
Religious.
It's religious.
That has nothing to do with his religion.
I'm sorry. Will, where are you from?
My dad's from Nigeria.
Come on,
from Lagos. And not only is he celebrating his culture and heritage on probably the biggest day of his life up to that point in his young life, he'll do much more. But also, we're a national immigrant month. You know, this brother's trying to be proud of his heritage, proud of his culture. Where Roots is airing right now. He probably had a little spirit.
So I'm trying to figure out, Michael, are you saying he shouldn't have worn it?
I'm saying that if the administrators would have asked him to take it off, he should have taken it off.
Okay, should the cast have escorted him out?
Absolutely not. No, I think that was too much. That was too excessive.
I'm saying he shouldn't have taken it off.
Well, the policy.
But I do think he should
have taken it off. You can't express who you are in a very respectful way.
Well, you can challenge that legally then. Yeah. But the fact of the matter is, the rules say what you can and cannot do.
I think
you
got a lawsuit.
You got to obey the rules. I think it's dumb as hell to have cops escorting a kid out of graduation because he had kente cloth on. That's just being stuck on stupid.
Yeah, it's not I don't disagree. What deal do you want to make out of it? And they want to make a big deal out of it.
Well, guess what? Elk Grove United School District. Y'all getting called out for being just stuck on stupid. All right.
That's your branding.
And hell, we might send y'all a whole bunch of kente cloth stoles for the next graduating class.
Right.
Coming up, actor, activist, and film director Nate Parker talks about Birth of a Nation, him playing Nat Turner, and how that's going to be a little problem for a lot of people who can't handle that much blackness. Next, News One Now, TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Last night on the remake of Roots on the History Channel, Nat Turner was brought into the story that slave rebellion in 1831 was a part of the story. But in October, it will be the focus of a new movie called Birth of a Nation. And it was directed by, it was financed by, he's also acting in it by Nate Parker. He and I sat down at the NAACP Image Awards in Los Angeles to talk about the film. Well, when we talked, Beyond the Lights, we had the screening.
Right.
You said, hey, man, I'm trying to do this Nat Turner film.
That's right.
I'm going to need your help. I said, whatever you need.
Whatever you need. That's what you said.
Now, all of a sudden,
here we are, right? You know, so you know I had to come sit down with you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But here's what you understand. So, it's out of the box directing. What caused you to say, I mean, I get the writing part, get acting in it, but say, you know what, I'm going to do that too.
Well, you know, it's controlling the narrative, you know what I mean? I think that far too often the material that represents our heroes, represents our, you know, our legacies, they're told by people that don't really understand our culture, don't understand the trauma, don't understand the triumph. So for me, I felt that for better or worse, I could create something that would project my vision, you know? So that was my hope. If I make the novice mistakes, if I can't learn everything that I can learn to get it done the way that would be perfect, I said, I'm gonna learn everything I can and I'm gonna tell the story. I want this to be a narrative for us, by us, that we can look to as a hope to change the narrative back to what it needs to be, and that's true.
So when you were working on other films, I mean, were you studying them? Were you studying what they were doing?
100%.
Were you questioning, quizzing, taking notes?
You know, it's funny because when I did The Great Debaters, as you know, Denzel directed that, and I asked him, you know, can I stand behind you every once in a while? You know, I think I want to get into directing at some point. And, you know, when I wasn't working, I'd dress up in costume and I'd stand over his shoulder and look and see what he was doing, see why he was doing it. And I learned a lot. And he's an actor director as well. So paid very close attention to those people that were in my life and really reached out to them when I decided I was going to take this step.
You mentioned earlier The Great Debaters. Mm-hmm. I look at Red Tails. Now this film, for you, looking at the body of your work, was it important to say, you know what, these are American stories,
right,
that Americans need to know about, that, you know what, I have to tell.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when dealing with our history, there's this misconception that when we resisted or when we did things to better our people, they were outside the ideals of what America is and what it was designed to stand for. And I don't think that's the case. I think that when you look at someone like Patrick Henry, you know, they said, give me liberty or give me death, who had slaves, that's a contradiction. You know, so for me, when it comes to people like, you know, Henry Lowe, comes to people like, you know, the people, you know, Easy, you know, from Red Tails, or Nat Turner, these are people that in so many ways represented what America is supposed to be, with respect to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So in a film like, you know, The Birth of a Nation with Nat Turner, my whole thing is, if you are white, if you're pink, you're peach, you're purple, you're green, you should be able to celebrate a man that stood for American ideals, that stood for peace, you know, without even having to interpret the color of his skin. So these are roles that I feel like I want to be a part of, because I feel like they change a narrative and I feel like they build a legacy.
I was talking to Reverend Jim Wallace, mm-hmm. and he was talking about a lot of those unbelievable things that happened during slavery and what took place. And this is when he said, black lives have never mattered.
Mm-hmm, right.
So when whites say, don't say black lives mm-hmm. matter, he said, no. They haven't mattered since 1619 in America.
Right, and we forget that. We forget that, you know, it was stated in our Constitution that people of color were three-fifths of a person.
And we had to keep trying to get laws to be passed just to fulfill what's actually in the Constitution.
And that's up until 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so my whole thing is, if we are to heal, we have to confront this, right? You know, you ask any psychologist, they say if anyone that's been through trauma at any level of their life, for them to get past it, there has to be honest confrontation. You can't berate people into change, you know? So with people that say, oh, well, you know, they pull yourself up by the bootstraps, reality is that we've been traumatized by the hands of someone. You know, if there's an oppressor to be named. So that said, it's like, yeah, in a sense, we're all victims. You know what I mean? There's a cycle that affects us all. I'm saying, let's look back, be honest about what happened, so we can talk about what happened. Then we can talk about a healing process, the medicine. That's what, this is a psychologist. I ain't a doctor that says these things. So it's like, my whole thing is healing through honest confrontation. But resistance has its place. You know, we talk about resistance as if it's not an option.
As if there was no American Revolution.
As if the country wasn't built on rebellion, right? A rebellion.
Right.
You know, if you look at the funny thing is, if you look at the words of Patrick Henry, right, when he gives these impassioned speeches, you can take those words and put it into Kunta Kinte's mouth, or Nat Turner's mouth, you know what I mean, to give someone that's mm-hmm. actually real. And they would make perfect sense. You know, freedom is our right as human beings.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's not like we're talking about something that's different or something that's foreign to America.
How has this process changed you as an artist and as an entrepreneur? Because you hit the pavement. Mm-hmm. You had to go out to raise the money. This was a venture capitalist project.
When I look at what it took to make this film, It was a rebellion. It was having a riotous disposition toward any system that told me that I couldn't do it. That said, no, it's not possible. No, you won't raise the money. No, no one wants to see a strong black man killing people that are, you know, of the Caucasian persuasion. When it came to raising money and people saying, you know, I don't know if this is a good business decision because people overseas don't want to see black people. And I'm like, wait, says who? Where's this self-perpetuating?
And there's two-thirds of people in the world are people of color.
But that's the thing. The reality is we send the siren out. You know, we create the paradigm, right? So it's like, it's having the courage, I think, in the faith to say, you know what? I will sacrifice everything to prove my point. And I think that that's, you know, when people talk about the civil rights movement of old versus new, the reality is the sacrifice that we're willing to put ourselves through is not something that is comfortable, is not something that is feels good, but it has to happen. I mean, I stopped working for 2 years, and I saw.
And I know I'm surely your people are going, Nate,
what's going on?
Nate, bro.
Dude, my wife is just like, I'm with you, but it's been 2 years, you know what I mean? And to go from having a career that is sustaining me in a great way to saying I will not work, and then asking myself, well, wow, I didn't even know I spent this much a month. You know what I mean? But when you have no income, and then being like, man, as a provider, I gotta go out and get it, but at the same time, I have to do this for my people. It made me feel the spirit of Nat Turner, who said, man, I have a wife and kid, and I could just fall back and say I have it good, because historically speaking, his slave owners weren't bad. He had a good setup, you know? But him saying, yes, I have a wife, yes, I have a daughter, but my people, what am I doing? I can complain, because we can have a long conversation about the things that need to happen in this country and in this industry, or we can really put ourselves in a position where we're accountable and responsible and take risks that can leave us with nothing.
All these black folks mm-hmm. who say, man, I'm sick of these slave films. I'm 12 Years a Slave. Mm-hmm. Oh, now you got Birth of a Nation. Mm-hmm. Now we've got to deal with the Underground series that John Legend is producing. Yeah. And I'm going, whoa, when you keep saying all of these, uh-huh. how many are we talking about?
Yeah.
I said, because I can tell you flat out, I've never heard somebody Jewish say, I'm about sick of these Holocaust films.
That's exactly right. We've been conditioned, right? Like you say, our Jewish brothers and sisters, their mantra is never forget.
Never forget.
Ours is get over it.
Move on. Don't bring it up.
Right. But like you said, when you speak to your, and it's so funny, I talked to one of my Jewish friends, and I said, what is your greatest fear? He said that another Holocaust will happen. He said, we have to be ready. We have to teach our children.
So I'm thinking to myself, man, like, what if we felt that way? What if we were like, never forget what happened to us? We're not indicting anyone, right? But internally, we're saying this has happened. You know, it's slavery with bondage that is like, whether it's psychological, or it's emotional, or it's physical, this happened to us. All of those things. And here we are saying, you know, but it's a condition. And so mm-hmm. people say, I don't want to see slave things. Why? Because in this culture, we've been conditioned to believe that the way to progress is to assimilate. Forget your culture, mm-hmm. push it away, be absorbed into the dominant culture, and you will have success, right? We talk about diversity. We never talk about it through the context of celebrating culture. We talk about it through the context of a palette, of a color palette, mm-hmm. right? If we have someone that's brown skin that is in this in this environment, it is a diverse environment. Not taking into consideration that there's a culture worth celebrating and a heritage worth holding up. So we just kind of got to reevaluate how we deal with diversity when it comes to how we deal with just how we deal with our history with respect to it's being a legacy that affects us today. All these things. And, you know, Carter G. Woodson, right? Carter G. Woodson said one of my favorite quotes. He said, "If you control a man's thinking, you don't have to tell him to go to the back door. He'll go on his own. And if there's no back door, he will cut one out for his pleasure." Right? So this is where, you know, it's not about how white people see us, it's how we've been conditioned to see ourselves.
Birth of a Nation hits theaters in October. Part two of my conversation with Nate Parker airs tomorrow, right here. News One Now on TV One, back in 60 seconds.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is, when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now. With Roland Martin.
Head out time. Martin. NFL running back Eddie Lacy turns 26, lost a lot of that weight. Comedian Wayne Brady turns 44. Actor Wentworth Miller, known for the series Prison Break, turns 44. Norm Lewis, who plays Edison Davis on Scandal, turns 53. Dennis Haysbert turns 62. Activist and author Cornel West, my frat, turns 63 Alfred. Years old. Well, Alfred as well. Actually, Alfred. Me, you, and Greg. That's right. Okay, folks, we got to go. Greg, Shermichael, Lauren, Will, thank you so very much. I'll see y'all tomorrow. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.